This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The shifting of populations in times of conflict. That's our theme this hour in an unusual portfolio of stories from the U.S. to Ukraine, from the current moment to looking back two decades in Rwanda, where a population declared war on itself with repercussions still being felt today. But we begin with what some in Moscow would have us believe are rival populations of Ukrainians and Russians. Is the crisis in Ukraine escalating into a possible pretext for Russian military action? Russian nationalist demonstrators are at the barricades in the pro-Russian Ukrainian city of Kharkiv. Here's the deputy Ukrainian foreign minister, Danilo Lubkivsky, speaking about the situation to the BBC.
We have received reports that clearly show this, that the situation remains dangerous, but so far it is taken under control and we have some positive changes in the situation. First of all, the buildings of our local authorities, Kharkiv and other cities, have been released. So those groups of provocateurs and pro-Russian-oriented manifestators have been located, and the general situation is under control.
Despite claims that the situation is under control, Ukraine's security forces are continuing to confront demonstrators in what it is calling, quote, an anti-terrorist operation. In reaction, there have been stern warnings to the Ukrainian government from Moscow that the use of violence against the demonstrators could result in an all-out civil war. We're joined now by Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Professor, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So all of these warnings and actions and flames in the square there in Kharkiv symbolize the tensions really behind the scenes. This is about more than just a couple of demonstrations.
It's not just Kharkiv either. It's also Donetsk and Luhansk, and there is violence elsewhere happening in Ukraine. It's especially disturbing because the pro-Russian demonstrators have not merely been taking over government buildings. They've also been taking over security force, Ukrainian security force buildings, and have been taking the weapons from those buildings. And so we know that, for example, in Luhansk, another of the eastern cities in Ukraine, they are still inside the security services building, and the security services building has an arsenal of 300 machine guns. And so that means presumably they have access to those guns.
How are we in the West? And I'll distinguish between persons like myself and then policymakers like John Kerry. How are we to distinguish between people who believe that Vladimir Putin has given them a kind of green light, I don't care what you do, for violence inside Ukraine versus actually instigating and being a part of a plot? Is there much of a difference at this point?
Well, it's really difficult to tell exactly who is doing what and for what motives, but we do know that in Donetsk, another one of the cities in eastern Ukraine, when the people first came into the city and demanded to see the mayor, they were asking for the mayor and trying to storm the opera house because they didn't know the difference between the opera house and the regional government building. And that would indicate that at best, they are not actually Donetsk residents who have lived there for a long time and know where's what in the city. One of the reporters who was on the scene there said that one of the people admitted to coming from Crimea. And so it's not clear that people are coming necessarily directly from Russia, but it does appear that they are coming from Crimea into eastern Ukraine to try to agitate on behalf of things that are not really local interests.
Kimberly Martin, let's step back for a moment. In the recent history, last half century of history in this part of the world, particularly in Ukraine, there's been a significant movement of populations. Who is an actual local, who is associated with a particular region and a city? Sometimes that can be difficult to determine, even if specifically people are coming in from Crimea and Moscow. Can you sketch out what the history has been over the last half century?
Oh, the last half century is, and if you go just a little bit beyond the last half century, it is so complex because the borders have changed so many times. Up until World War II broke out, the territory that is now Ukraine was divided between what was then the early days of the Soviet Union on the one side and an attempt at a reconstituted Poland on the other side. But even just a few decades before that, it had been split between multiple empires, with part of it being long long-term in the Russian Empire, another part being long-term in the Habsburg Empire. So, I mean, going back in history, the population movements have been incredible. And then, of course, in Soviet times, there wasn't really a distinction between Ukraine and Russia and Moldova and Belarus and any of these other areas that are now separate countries. They were all just republics within the Soviet Union. And so people would go from one place to another, depending on where the jobs and where the industries were. And so there's been just an immense amount of population change over time. What we do know is that the last time that a Ukrainian census was taken, which was back in 2001, they probably haven't dared to take one since then because of how explosive the ethnic situation could potentially be. But in 2001, we know that throughout these eastern cities in Ukraine, the level of the population who identified themselves as being ethnically Russian was somewhere in the high 30%. So like 37-38% of the population in these cities identified as being ethnically Russian, with the majority identifying as being ethnically Ukrainian.
And that, while not a majority, is a sizable enough fraction of the population to create the kinds of instabilities that we are seeing if people feel threatened or feel emboldened to take to the streets.
And the thing is, it would be very unusual for people to actually feel threatened because there has not been any threatening activity that has come from the government in Kyiv to these areas. It's all based on a sense of rumors, you know, maybe fears about what might happen in the future. Certainly there are Ukrainian nationalist groups who are a very small minority who are violent, but they have not really taken out violence against Russians for being Russian. And so it appears that if there are fears, the fears have been artificially stoked. It's not that something has happened that has caused people to feel threatened.
But would you say as the weeks go on here, I mean, the Russians claim that the change of government in Kyiv was the result of a coup. They're continuing to call it a coup against Yanukovych. As time goes on, can Russia more credibly make the case that this constitutes some sort of crackdown against Russian nationalists? And what would you say the Ukrainian government needs right now from the West and from other allies in Europe to maintain its territorial integrity and legitimacy in the eyes of the world?
Well, that's a very complex set of questions that you've just asked there, John. So let's go back to the one about the coup. What actually happened is that the former leader, Yanukovych, decided to flee the country, and he fled the country after his own forces had fired on demonstrators. And there had been violence on both sides as the demonstrations progressed in January and February. But it's important to remember that the first step in all of this that really caused things to unravel was Yanukovych's police forces, his special police operations forces, firing on protesters who were peaceful. And so that's where everything began back in the fall. And it was at that point, when the original protests were about joining Europe and were peaceful, that the forces coming from the then Ukrainian government fired on those protesters and carried out violence against those protesters. And that's what caused the protests to massively scale up in size. And at that point, the protesters were not agitating on behalf of joining Europe. They were agitating against the human rights violations and against the violence that was being practiced by the Ukrainian regime. But there really wasn't a coup. What happened was that Yanukovych fled the country, and at that point, the legislature that had been freely and fairly elected, as much as you can talk about free and fair elections, because they were the same kinds of elections that brought in the president who fled, but the people who had been elected, the legislature in the country, the parliament in the country, was the one who took over. And that there was nobody really else who could have taken over. And so calling it a coup is being disingenuous. It certainly, it was an ambiguous situation. But what happened, the takeover that did happen, was with the people who were left in the country, who were the most legitimate force that you could possibly think of as being left in the country. Now, in terms of what Ukraine needs to protect its territorial integrity, I'm not sure it's going to get it. What Ukraine would need to protect its territorial integrity is military support coming from NATO. And that's not going to happen. Ukraine is not a NATO member. NATO has no interest in getting militarily involved in the situation. And the truth is that Russian security forces, Russian military forces are strong enough that if Russia decided to come over the border, they would find themselves enmeshed in a civil war. It would not be an easy thing, but they could, with fighting, manage to control all of Ukraine. They would then find themselves fighting a massive insurgency, a massive guerrilla campaign, probably coming from the Ukrainians. But there really is nothing physically that the Ukrainians can do to stop the Russians from doing that. And so the situation that the Ukrainians find themselves in is just trying to negotiate, trying to figure out if there's some way to convince Russia not to go in. But they're not going to get what they would need from the West to stop Russia from going in.
You characterized Vladimir Putin's accusation that it was a coup that changed the government in Kiev as disingenuous when the Russians say more violence will cause civil war. I mean, those are pretty frightening words.
That's also disingenuous, because what's provoking everything is the support that's coming from Russian territory and now from Russian-occupied Crimea. And the people who are taking over these government buildings are stealing weapons and are acting violently. And so to claim that somehow it's Ukraine that's provoking this is a lie. It is just turning things on its head. And it's the kind of thing that we would expect somebody who is a KGB operative, which is what Putin's background is. He is very good at using information campaigns. He always has been. And it's an information campaign. But I think it's important to sort out what the truth is. The situation is obviously ambiguous, but so far it's not the Ukrainian government that's using force. It's these people who are calling themselves pro-Russian protesters, but who don't know where their own regional government building is in the city of Donetsk, who are probably following the same pattern of what happened in Crimea, which is that it was not locals who were doing it. It was people coming over from the Russian side who were essentially KGB operatives or, in some cases, even special operations forces who came in civilian clothes and then turned out to have some form of military uniforms hidden. So, I mean, this is Russia that's doing this. This is not people who are just frightened Russian-speaking citizens of the eastern Ukrainian areas.
Helping to clarify the complicated situation in Ukraine right now, Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me back.